Thank you all for coming. Let's get this out of the way first. Let's see. So if you want to give me feedback, I know that they're sending out an email at the end of the week, but if you want to yell at me like immediately, you can find me on Twitter at Alice Goldfuss, and I also made a channel for this talk in the unofficial, official Lisa Slack. It's just called Meat for Structure. You can figure it out. So let's start here. First of all, kudos to everyone for coming to a talk with the word meat for structure in it. It was originally in flesh structure, so you're welcome. Let's get the boring stuff out of the way first. I'm Alice. Hello. I am a site reliability engineer at New Relic. New Relic is a SaaS solution for software analytics and application performance management. Our stack is actually pretty cool. We've got Docker, Kafka, Cassandra, all in production. And I'd love to talk about that at some point. But for the purposes of this talk, all you need to know is about a year ago, our operations team looked like this. And now it looks like this. Plus more. We more than doubled in a year and are now some 30 engineers supporting over 200 developers across different cities, states, and countries and time zones. And while that growth was really exciting and really great, our meat infrastructure wasn't exactly able to handle it, at least not at first. Which of course brings us to that question that historians and scholars have been asking for centuries. What is meat infrastructure? Well, meat infrastructure is what your system rests on. It's not hardware or AWS or that cardboard box you found in the woods that runs Gentoo. Meat infrastructure is people. Your infrastructure is not technology, it's people. Because at the end of the day, people are the ones that evaluate those technologies, deploy them, and then patch them at 3 a.m. when they broke. And meat infrastructure is the processes and resources that give those people what they need to do their jobs. And when people don't have the resources they need to do their jobs, things start to get a bit shaky. And while New Relic didn't exactly suffer this past year, we definitely hit some speed bumps along the way as we scaled out our teams. And I put this talk together and hoped someone else could learn from our efforts and how we got it all put together. Yes, I saw someone make a cringing face at this picture. That's some feelings coming out given our structural expansion. I expanded this talk into 5 topics that I named after vaguely technical terms because I thought that would get my talk accepted. And it worked. So, nota bona. Let's dive right into it with enable logging. Who here knows what the bus factor is? Good, good. And who here thinks they have a good bus factor? Mm-hmm. Yes. Confident person. So according to Wikipedia, the bus factor is the number of developers it would need on that team to lose in order for a team or a project to lose its institutional memory and halt its progress. What does that mean? That means if you have some people on your team that are working on projects and they get hit by a bus, or a truck, or some other vehicle of manslaughterish nature, would you be okay? How many people could you lose on your team in a survivor-like scenario before everything would come to a grinding halt? And what you want to do is increase that factor. Having a higher bus factor is what you are aiming for here. And that brings me to my very first point, which is the hardest thing you're gonna have to do, and thus it's the first one, and that is to convert your culture from an oral to a written one. A lot of you probably have institutional knowledge, which is the idea that the password to this old legacy system is hidden in someone's brain back when this was just a company of 2 people down in someone's basement. Well, everything's fine when you're 2 people in a basement, besides the fact that you get missed on everything else. If something breaks, you can just lean over to the person next to you and say, "Hey, did you break this?" And they can be like, "Yeah." But as you start to expand to different time zones, it is much harder to get that information out. So you have to start to write it down. Why is that important? Well, here's a story. A couple of months ago, one of our internal LDAP servers took a dirt nap one night. which was fine for most of the services that were configured to use multiple LDAP servers, but some of them, such as Jenkins, were only configured to use one. And, of course, no one could get in to build or run their jobs because they couldn't authenticate. It was pretty easy for me to SSH in and delete the security config, but in my haste, I forgot to write down our credentials and our parameters. Luckily, after I switched over to another LDAP server, I remembered that the engineer that put authentication in place in the first place wrote a very detailed runbook about what he did, including our credentials. And I was able to go find that runbook and put authentication back in place without having to wake up anyone else. It was very helpful. And that's what this is all about, because you're not just making someone else's life better, someone else is helping make your work better as well. So you need to write it all down. And I do mean everything. Not just network topologies or maintenance tasks, although you should still write those down too. But things like your team's mission, your chosen methodologies and tools, or even things like, how do you attend a conference? What's your plan for that? How did all of you decide to attend this conference? Did you alert your manager? Are you the manager that decided to come? How is it paid? Is it okay if you speak at conferences? How do you decide which conferences to go to? These are things that need to be discussed and then written down for everyone to see because it saves you time in the long run. People can just go read that docs instead of coming to you in person and wasting your time. And sometimes you get pushback from this because people say, well, I don't want to write it down because A, that takes a lot of time, and B, then it's unchangeable and it's this big process. Well, it can be a living document. You can put it in like a repo and have people put pull requests on it and communicate and merge it just like any other change you would make. And it's easier to work on something and iterate on it once you have it written down. So start writing it down. Every ticket and every task you do should have time built in for documentation, like what we did for that LDAP server. And you should also empower everyone on your team to ask for docs. If someone on your team says, hey, I just deployed this cool new tool, someone else on your team should be able to say, okay, where are the docs for that? And the other person would be like, oh, I wrote them. Or, yes, thank you for reminding me that I need to write those docs. Everyone should feel like they can do that so that the information is okay to write down. So let's ship this. I'm giving you homework. In addition to writing things down, how can you actually deploy this in your team? Well, you can start by doing more pairing. And I think this is an excellent representation of pairing in that it is two birds on some barbed wire screaming. And that's a lot like pairing. And you should do more of that. And not just pair programming, but on tasks. Even small tasks, like making small load balancer configurations, you might think, well, everyone on my team already knows how to do that. And that's possible, but you also probably have more junior engineers or even a DBA or two who don't know things at the network level, and it's easy enough to have them sit next to you for 10 minutes while you explain what you're doing. And while this doesn't exactly cover the bus factor completely, what you do is you foster secondary skills, and you spread out the ability of your team to diagnose an issue. So if the network person isn't exactly available at 2 a.m., but it's the database person's stuff that's failing on the network level, they might have a better idea of what to look at or what to point at other people on. And that will start to raise your bus factor. So next up, let's pipe standard out. So congratulations, you got people to start writing things down. But you had an incident, some of your servers went offline, magically of course, and you want your engineers involved to write down their investigations. Well, where do they do that? Engineer number one uses your internal wiki, which is good. Engineer number two does a shared Google Docs, which is also good, but not as discoverable for other people. Engineer number three does a team email, which gets eyes on it, but isn't very good for new hires just coming on the scene. And engineer number four is fired. Writing things down is great, but it doesn't mean anything if it's not organized. What you need is a single source of truth. Single source of truth has a couple of requirements. Everyone knows where it is, everyone can contribute to it, it's searchable, and it's archivable. And that last one in particular, chat ops people, I'm sorry, but chat programs do not count as archivable things. You need to have them in a place that will stand the test of time and it's not in between everyone's emoticons. Yes. I feel like I'm in a jazz club now. A lot of engineering at New Relic actually uses GitHub for documentation. We have complete repos for runbooks. We use GitHub pages for company processes. We have our own like Jekyll-generated page site that you can look at things like how to attend a conference. For configuration changes, we use small GISs if they're just one-off tasks. And this is really great, and engineering knows how to gain access to those repos if they need them. In addition to GitHub, our HR uses our company wiki, which is Atlassian Confluence. A lot of our product managers use Quip. And yes, I know, these are all different things, but what's important is that everyone that needs that information knows where to go. Marketing knows where to look for marketing things, engineering knows where to look for engineering things, and they can get what's necessary to do their jobs, and that's what's important. Now, at this point, you're probably thinking, hold up, is this a talk about documentation? Because your first point was about documentation, and your second point is also about documentation, and lady, do you know who I am? I'm an engineer. I work at WebScale. I treat my servers like cattle. I don't have time to write it all down. I don't have time for your documentation. Well, you're right. You are an engineer, and you do treat your servers like cattle, but interestingly enough, you know who's really into organization and documentation? Cattle ranchers. In fact, if you do a search for something like organize cattle, you will see a number of hits for different types of software used to organize herds. My favorite is CattleMax. You can even put it on your phone and have it wherever you want. It has everything you need. Resource tracking, performance metrics, and inventory management, including how many fall calving cows you have. Do your servers tell you that? If you want to treat your servers like cattle, you need to be at least as organized as a cattle rancher. End of talk, drop mic. So let's ship this. Following in CattleMax's steps, why don't you put that whole DevOps thing to the test and actually write an app? I mocked one up that I call What's on Fire Today? It's just some simple servers that represent hosts in your infrastructure. It can be a front end for Nagios or your own API. Problem hosts float to the top or can be pinned there. And people on your team can even make notes to discuss what exactly went wrong with that host. And this is a great way to provide an application that's in one place that everyone, no matter what time zone they're on, can check in at any point of the day to get the state of your infrastructure at a glance. So it doesn't all just have to be documentation. It can be something like this, way more accessible. Default configuration. So at this point, you've introduced the idea of having processes and docs internally on your team, and that's pretty much accepted. But how does that fit into your greater company architecture? I mean, I'm guessing you're supporting other engineers. They need your help in ordering and provisioning hardware, troubleshooting operating systems, or just gaining access to systems and tools. I mean, how do you handle that amount of requests? Is each one new territory? It's definitely stressful. What do you do to make sure that everything moves in a very smooth fashion? Well, I'm going to give you a couple of valves you can put into place to stem the flood of developer requests and make things a little more sane. The first one is the hero role. This started out at New Relic for our support engineers to talk to our development engineers. We had it mapped one-to-one, like the Python support team would talk to the Python engineers, and at first, support team would just ask any engineer available for help. Then we introduced the hero role. And on a rotating basis, one engineer per development team would be available to be the interruptible for such questions, so everyone else could be heads down. And this eventually spread to the rest of our company, so now every engineering team, whether they interface with support or not, would have a hero. This is great. It's also good for onboarding new hires, especially. After they get their legs under them, you throw them into the hero role, and man, they learn your infrastructure fast. Another thing we implemented is office hours, which is something that the hero also does. Every time, every day, at the same time and place, we have office hours where the hero will be sitting waiting to take developer requests. This is great for non-emergency things. People just drop into our chat room every day and say, hey, how do I provision a new service? We can say, do you need this now, or can you come to office hours? And usually they say, oh yeah, office hours, and then they just go take a nap. If coming to office hours later means that we can prepare to talk to them, we can set up either an in-person meeting or a video call so it's more planned as opposed to just getting in between other people's chats. And it allows us to prepare for it for longer discussions and everyone leaves happier in the end. It's way more condensed and smooth. We also have defined processes for requests. Now, I'm sure most of you have a ticketing system. And I'm sure most of you also like to complain about how other people use your ticketing system. Have you actually tried to tell them what you want to see in your ticketing system? Try guiding them in how to actually fill out tickets and the information you need to help them help you. You should actually sit down and train them or provide documentation that they can use to figure out how do I file a ticket for a new service. For example, for us, any access requests require a ticket with a manager sign-off so we can do security auditing later and we know that this just isn't someone trying to get the keys to all the things. After all, if you don't provide such interfaces, you're going to end up with something like this, which is usable but horrible at the same time. You need to define how other teams are going to use the infrastructure you manage, because as you grow, people are just going to want to pop in little one-off things, and you're going to end up with a lot of special snowflakes. There will be more and more opportunities for people to sneak in little proofs of concepts, you know, like, oh, no one else here uses Node, but I do, so I'm just going to drop this in here. That's cool, right? And then it becomes something that's majorly supported, and it's your team that's going to have to support it. So you need to make sure that that is set up right away, that you have those barriers in place so people know what is allowed and what isn't. You should have a defined architecture by now, and if you don't, that's another talk completely. I can't help you there. You should already know what your approved languages and frameworks are, and you need to document these other places so other teams know what you will and will not accept. So again, what's approved? Languages, frameworks, tools. I don't care what these definitions are, if it's Rails on the front end, Java on the back end, Squirrel everywhere, that's an actual language. Just whatever, as long as it's defined and your team is prepared to support it, write it down, make it official, and again, it can be changed. People can always make a better case for why Go should be in there instead of Squirrel, which, like, what? That's a terrible name. But it needs to be defined so other people know what you're going to actually support. How about a real-world example? As I mentioned before, we run Docker in production. We've been running Docker in production for almost 2 years now, which is really great. Except, we never really told people how to use Docker in our architecture. The majority of our applications now use Docker, but every time someone had to spin up something new in Docker, they had to sit down with us, and everyone gave them slightly different information. There was no one true source of information on this. I sat down earlier this year and conversed with everyone that had their fingers in the Docker pie to figure out how exactly we were expecting people to deploy with Docker. And I wrote thorough documentation on how to do this. So now, if you're a developer spinning up, say, a Rails app in our architecture, there is a great documentation repo just for you that explains what Docker is, how we use it in New Relic, the special tools we wrote to support it, and gives you pre-rolled base images that you just have to attach to your application and build with Docker to actually deploy. And let me tell you, that has been fantastic. It has been a lot less heartache and headaches on both sides. And while they still need to be updated all the time, that was also just, it was a really good gesture of faith to our developers that we weren't just leaving them in the dust with all our cool new architecture. And now, if they have special questions, it's usually because they've already read the documentation and have additional things. And that we can handle on a one-by-one basis. But for the majority of things, point the developers at our Docker docs, hey, and everything goes a lot better. So let's ship this. Talking back to ticketing systems and how to help others help you, we recently launched an internal request UI. It's just a Rails app built on some Google Forms that hooks into the Jira API. And people can come in here to request user access and currently monitoring. We've got provisioning coming later. But if you click on one of these, it presents you with a Google form that leads you through all of the fields that we need to get information from you to then make a JIRA ticket, which it does automatically, to then provision or provide monitoring or access for you. Because before this, every time someone needed access, they would either hit us up in the chat room or come to office hours, and then we would sit down with them and actually write down the ticket with all the things they needed, and it just took way too long. Now they can self-serve. No one has to talk to us, which is great, because who wants to talk to us? And everyone is a lot happier. And again, this is a DevOps approach. We used a development strategy to solve an operations problem. So moving on to stable distribution. So all right, it's cool. You've got your local team situated with docs and processes, and you even talk to the other teams in your office on how to talk to your team. But everyone knows distributed systems are the new hotness. This is a representation of a distributed system in that you break something up into pieces and people give you money. You will eventually need to hire remote workers. And a lot of people kind of cringe at that, and you really shouldn't, because remote workers are awesome. It ensures you have the best talent available and not just the talent that's available and local and wants to commute and can deal with your face. You can cover different shifts by having different people in different time zones. A lot of people think of things like Google for this, but I actually really like to talk about WordPress. WordPress has developers all across the world, and they actually have a follow the sun model where they hand off different responsibilities by their shift. There's actually a good book on this. I think it's called The Year Without Pants. Yes, talking about being a remote worker, because pretty much all of their workforce is distributed. So I would recommend reading that. Remote workers can also attend conferences that are local to them but far away from you. And this is also really beneficial if your company has international customers or impact. For example, we have an office in Dublin, Ireland, and it's really great to have actual Irish employees that can talk to European people on the same level as them, as opposed to a clumsy American like me trying and just failing. Who here has been a remote employee? Who would be a remote employee again? Okay, actually a little bit less of you. And that's a little expected because while it's great to have remote employees, it can be difficult to actually have remote employees. I was a remote employee once. This is a picture of me from that time. I started out in an office and then moved away to become their first remote employee, and we had nothing in place to support me, and it was pretty much terrible. So why was it terrible? Well, as soon as I moved, I was immediately left out of the daily chatter and camaraderie that I had taken for granted while in office. I had no idea who our new hires were. I had no idea what was going on in the office. Sometimes I would show up for work and not realize that people had gone off to do like a luncheon or something without me. My learning slowed. It pretty much plateaued. It was easy when I was in the office to hear people talking about different technologies so I could go research them on my own. But it turns out you can't actually research things if you don't know they exist. So as soon as I was out of the office and not talking to people, I had no idea what to learn next or what to do. And out of sight, out of mind. Pretty much as soon as I moved out of the office, my manager kept giving me more and more receptionist-like abilities because clearly I'm, you know. Anyway, he seemed to forget why I was hired in the first place and what my actual job was. Hint, it was technical and not being a receptionist. And as soon as I got out of the office, I was basically just shoved down the totem pole farther and farther. Now, hopefully, your remote experiences were not at all like this. But I think we can all agree that expanding your workforce like this can open up kind of a cornucopia of bad times if you're not careful. And whether you're the manager or another employee, you need to take extra steps to ensure that everyone is on equal footing. So what's the first thing you can really do? What's the main theme here? Remember that remote workers are not second-class citizens. If anything, the fact that you want them to work remote for you speaks highly of their skills. I mean, you don't care if they're in a murder shack somewhere with like T1 cables nailed to the trees. You want them to work for you. So you should really respect them and treat them as the highly involved and prized employees that they are. So how can you do that? Well, you should level the playing field. Take notes during stand-ups. We actually have a Hubot script, if anyone here is familiar with the MIT Hubot program, that we have a script that someone wrote in our company, and you can just do a stand-up command, and then everyone will talk at Hubot giving their stand-up notes. It then saves that and publishes it to a GitHub gist, which creates a great archive and lets people who are not on our time zone to go and check out what other people on their team are working on. We record meetings and we post them internally on an app that we wrote. And fly them in. We always fly people in pretty much whenever they want, although you should do a quarter or at least once a month if you want to really impress me. Because there's nothing that really compares to that in-person, face-to-face bonding, whether it's being able to lean over to someone and ask them what they're doing or taking them out to lunch afterwards. You can also consider the Matt Headroom approach. This is Matt. He is one of our remote employees, and we always have a laptop up in our section with him on it. Yep. It's kind of creepy sometimes, because if he leaves his mic on, I can hear him typing, and I think that there's like insects behind me, and it's weird. But it's also great, because you remember that he's there, and if I have a question, I don't have to find him on HipChat and try to explain things with words I don't know. I can just sit next to him and talk to him like I would any other employee. And it also, it just keeps them right there and visible for you. You should also make sure that your remote employees get the same swag as your local team. Hoodies, stickers, conference attendees. If you're taking your team out to lunch, you should send your remote workers a gift card to a nearby restaurant. Make them feel included and remembered. Because at the end of the day, you want them to be empowered to act as a full-fledged member of your team. Allow them to steer new efforts, write new docs, and ask people to speak up if they're being too quiet on video calls. That's really important, because it's so often, video software, I was just complaining about this on Twitter earlier. It's kind of difficult, and you're 10 minutes into a meeting, and no one can hear you, and you can't hear them. You really need to make sure that everyone knows that it's important that your remote employees can participate in this discussion. So don't leave them out. So let's ship it. Give your next big project to a remote employee. And if this makes you cringe, well, that's probably a reflection on your processes. If you hear yourself saying, oh, I would totally give it to Shauna, but you know, she wouldn't be able to communicate with people, and you know, she's on a different time zone, well, that's something that you need to work on. Because having a remote employee work on a next big project not only increases their visibility, but it will expose the weak points in your documentation, communication, and shared processes. And you wouldn't deny someone in your office a project, so you shouldn't deny it to your remote employees. Your remote employees should not just be the life support for your maintaining systems. They should be able to steer and guide new efforts. Reliable under high load. So we're almost done. Well, I am, but you're not, because you have to grow your team now. Onboarding a new employee should just involve pointing them to some docs and giving them an onboarding buddy to ask questions. That's it. Because anything more on that is a drain on resources. Yes, I had to use this picture. I mean, you don't expect your new hire to hit the ground running, but you also don't expect to lose 3 other engineers in the process helping to onboard them. But if your docs are out of date, or the proper login is stored in someone's head who's on PTO, your whole team could be slowed down as a result, and you don't want that kind of technical debt. Some companies have the concept of a first day commit. Are the people here understanding of what I mean when I say first day commit? So a first day commit is a small piece of code or action that you have your new hire do on their very first day, usually in production. It can be just changing a spelling mistake or something like that, very small, but it allows them to instantly get into your code so they feel accepted and capable and understand that it's not so scary, and they get to understand your systems more and help them feel accepted. And it's also a great test of your processes. However, if your first commit is more like a first week commit, that's not good. We've had that. It's not good. Don't do that. It should be short and to the point, and it should make them feel like they can hit the ground running or at least start to learn things as soon as they get in instead of having to fight with some archaic vagrant setup. So where can you start on this? Well, if you're a big shop, you probably have some sort of official employee training program or onboarding, yeah? You should make sure it includes an overview of your infrastructure or your network system or whatever you need your new hires to know. You need to get invested in this. You can't brush off proper onboarding and then complain when your new employees are ignorant of your systems. You need to sit down with your trainers and tell them what you need these particular employees to know as they onboard. If you're a smaller shop, you've got less resources like that, but you have to also get creative and also get invested. Write good docs or make training videos. Have a list of useful links to hand over on their first day, even just things like, you know, where's the cafeteria? Anything to help them get started and make them feel welcomed. Arrange a team lunch or a team meeting so that everyone on your team can meet the new person. I say team meeting in case you have remote workers who aren't on your schedule for lunch. Make sure that they understand that you have remote employees as well. And for those of you thinking, I'll just have the new person fix our docs on their first day because they'll just be able to figure out as they go. It's a good experience for everyone. It'll be fine. Well, turns out that's not that clever of an idea. And all you're actually doing is trumpeting how little you value your new employees' time. So ship it. As I mentioned, you should have an onboarding buddy. You should pick an engineer on your team and make them go through all of your first day processes and onboarding material before you get your new hire. This way, it is fresh in their mind and they can help that onboarder on their first day. It's way nicer as a first day employee to sit down and say, I don't know how to do this, and have someone next to you being like, I did this last week, this is who you have to talk to, this is how it's done. And we found that the best people for this are the people that are your most recent new hires before your new person, maybe like a month out. Give them a couple of weeks and then make them someone else's onboarding buddy because they only recently went through it themselves. It's great. So we talked about five things in these vaguely technical terms, but they actually mean this. Share your info in one place, help other teams help you, make remote workers equal, and make onboarding smooth. And we discuss specific ways to implement these goals on your team. For example, for sharing info, you should share your knowledge by pairing to grow skill sets on your team and writing your docs down. You want it to all be in one place? How about you make a very nice web app that is not at all something I made in GIMP? To help other teams help you, how about you teach them how to interface with you? Whether it's just sitting them down and guiding them how to use your ticketing resources or to make an actual app to guide them through it so you never have to talk to them. Make remote workers equal by including them in the discussion and giving them projects to lead on their own. And make onboarding smooth by, again, giving them an onboarding buddy and making sure all your processes are complete before they arrive. So the overall theme here is to help your engineers help themselves. Write things down, make them accessible, make sure everyone knows the proper resources that they need, whether it's an app or another engineer. And make sure that the other teams you interact with know that while scalable systems are cool, they are nothing without competent engineers. Thank you. All right, we've got time for some questions if you have any. Right here.
Comment more than a question. The problems you're referring to with remote employees, I've seen smaller versions of the same thing happen when a team is growing and you end up with people who are sitting outside of the room that the rest of the team is in. They get left out.
You mean physically left out? Like they're in the same space and they sit outside? We've definitely had that, and we have had to crab people into different spaces, but we've been pretty good about making sure that everyone has a seat in the proper area. People know about new hires. Maybe we're not at the acceleration where we have a new hire every day. We have a new hire every maybe a couple of weeks or so. So the managers know which desk they're going to be at, and if they don't have room, they work with our office staff to make sure that person has a desk. But yes, you should definitely make sure that people are involved with their team physically in the space if they can be so, or even just temporarily take over a conference room until your space requirements can be met at your team area. Yes?
What frequency would you recommend? Half an hour a day?
So the question was about what frequency I would recommend for pair programming on tasks. It would be good if your hero has time to do this, they're usually handling developer-like requests. They could just grab someone on the team and just rotate for what tasks they're doing. So each task would maybe take between 10 and 20 minutes, depending on what it is. You can also have someone that just works with you throughout it. We have to have changes approved if they're going into production, which means we have to write out very specifically what we're going to be changing. So you could have someone work with you to explain what we have to write out, and then being your co-pilot when you actually deploy those changes, and then rotate it that way. But as for frequency, as a manager, you can decide who does what when and make sure you vary the tasks that they've used. You can also just make it kind of obvious if you have a hero-specific chat room what you're gonna be working on and let people volunteer to pair with you. And that usually balances itself out so people aren't taking up too much time from the rest of their work. Yes?
So you spent quite a bit of time in the beginning
So the question was, documentation fatigue is a thing where engineers get really overworked and don't have time to write things down, and do we have systems in place to make sure documentation gets written? So we always try to schedule time in your task. So if you have like, and if you're familiar with Jira, where you can be like, this is this many points, we try to include a half point or whatever that unit of measurement would be dedicated to documentation. So your task is incomplete until it's been documented somewhere. We also have an app part of our internal deploy structure. If you want to deploy an application, for example, it has to have a README attached for how to deploy that app, and the system will not let you deploy unless you can attach that README. So that takes care of deploying new services. They have to have a README as part of their repo for that app to pick up. Otherwise, one of our teams, it actually acts as an interruptible team for all of site engineering, because as opposed to development teams that might be talking to a couple of other development teams, site engineering supports all of engineering. So we have a team dedicated to being kind of an interruptible role for all of engineering, and they are usually the ones that are saying, hey, you rolled out this new service that developers are asking about, where are the docs? So it's really just a system of everyone keeping them in place and managers being on board saying, yeah, you need to write the docs for that. Go do it. In the back. The question was, is there a way to measure our success, or is it just so obvious that we don't need to measure it? We do not have specific metrics on this right now. I will say seeing things deploy faster and having, it's usually a lot of anecdotal stuff. So when we released the request application with the Google Forms, we had a half dozen developers being like, thank you so much for doing this. This makes things so much easier. And you can actually see the Jira requests coming in because people are using this application now. So no, we don't have actual trackable metrics, which we should because, you know, we like data. But we have anecdotally seen at least morale improving with people interfacing with us and actually wanting us around more instead of thinking of us as like the cranky people that guard things. So yeah, we should figure out some metrics like that. And if you have any recommendations, I would love to talk to you. In front.
So related to the enforcement question. Mm-hmm. In the bell curve of people, there are people who are willing to share more than others.
You can, yes.
Prod them, and you can prod them, and you can say, you know, pairing is good. This is good for, you know, you can go on a vacation, etc. But there are just simply some people who just have a hard time sharing than others. So everybody here has dealt with it to some degree. I'm wondering if you guys have encountered that and what you've done about it.
So yes, there are definitely those people that do not want to share, and there's a couple different ways to go about that. Depending on your company's policies, I mean, if it is company policy that they need to read documentation down and it's important, we have a concept of two jobs. Your main job, your first job, is your technical job, writing code, deploying systems. Your second job, which you are evaluated on for things like promotions and just performance review level things, involve things like writing documentation and mentoring others and sharing things. And so if you're only doing your first job, you are not seen to be a stellar employee, and that can actually impact some of your progression. So that's kind of a passive-aggressive way to get people to share. But as for the people that are absolutely stalwart and not sharing, I mean, I would bring that up. I'd be like, you know, that's not our culture here. You're holding people back. You know, we had an incident caused because you worked on something and didn't tell anyone about it, and that needs to be an improvement in your performance. If you really wanted to do some hand-holding, you could pair them with another engineer and have the first engineer walk through their process and have the second engineer write it down. But you need to be careful because you don't want to be enabling behavior where people can just be cowboys and expect someone else to clean up their mess. I mean, yeah, it's difficult, but having the managers be on board with it and saying this can impact your performance if you don't write your stuff down helps. It also, I mean, for me personally, my team, we've got people that have written books for O'Reilly. They're used to writing out step-by-step instructions for remote hands and the such. So people are on board with writing documentation. And they also kind of give into peer pressure if someone says, why didn't you write docs for this? So it is a cultural change. Let's go with you, ma'am. So the question is, how do you keep the rest of your team from stepping up to be heroes when you have a designated hero? And wow, that would be really cool if everyone on my team wanted to be the interruptible all the time. Usually it's the other way around. What we do with the hero role is, okay, so in that case, I would recommend reminding people that the hero role is there so that that person can also learn things. And if they needed help with something, they can then turn to someone internally in their team and ask them how to do something, which you'll see with new hires all the time. That's one of the reasons we throw them into the fire, is because they have to learn your systems, but pretty much every time they get a new question, they're saying, let me check on that for you, developer, turning around to the person next to them and going, how do I do this? That way they learn from people in your team, and the people on your teams can also be temporary heroes for whatever their specialties are. Otherwise, I would just remind them, like, hey, we're doing project work, keep your heads down, you'll get to be hero next week, and then you get to answer all the questions and feel like a superstar. You can also have people do rotating office hours, if you wanted to split that up. Have your hero do office hours, but then have a secondary hero as well. There was another question around here. Yes, sir? Which was the hardest lesson for us to learn? Write it all down. That was why it was the first one. This talk was actually inspired because at like 11 p.m. one night, something broke, and the cowboy that wrote it didn't write it down, and I got so mad, and I was just like, you want a talk, Lisa? I'll give you a talk. And then they accepted it. And I was like, crap. So yeah, definitely the first one, teaching people to write it all down, especially when you had that institutional knowledge or those three people that were like, we've been ops for this company since the beginning. We don't have time to write all that down. Why don't you new people handle that? Getting everyone to write it down and be on board with documentation is a cultural change. I've said that before. It has to come down from the top, and that was the hardest thing for us to do and implement. Yep, go ahead.
Maybe one last question.
One more, right here. Sure, studies on how pairing does and does not work. Different people have different styles. We have specific pairing stations in our office, a couple of them with like dual monitors, so people can rent or reserve those stations to go use. I really like the driver-navigator paradigm, if people have heard of that one. So it's the idea of the person that knows what's going on stands to the side and does the navigating, and the person that doesn't know what to do is the driver. And the person sits next to them and tells them what to do and guides them through it. So the person that is unfamiliar with this concept has to learn by doing, and then they can switch off if needed. And that's probably my favorite one. So developers tend to be more time-boxed in that they're like, okay, let's reserve this for an hour and see how far we get. In site engineering, it's a little more party-ish, where everyone's just kind of yelling all the time. And we have our own corner. And for that, it's more like, pull up a chair, let's see what we can do, kind of a thing. Yep.
All right, can we have a round of
applause? Thank you.